This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Well, bringing you all the up-to-date information on sexual health and well-being. Brought to you by the Victorian AIDS Council on Joy 94.9. Joy.
Good evening, lovely people. This is Well on Joy 94.9, brought to you every week by the Victorian AIDS Council, where we talk about sex, drugs, rock and roll, and all the fun stuff that affects your health and well-being as part of the queer community. I'm joined this evening by Cal. Hello, sir. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. And how are you?
Yeah, you know, I'm all right. Could use some coffee, but
And see, I dosed up already, so I'm too jittery. It's a bad choice.
Yeah, I'll smack you down later if you act up.
Oh, swell. So this week's kiss is about same-sex violence.
Actually, this week we will be talking about a pair of our favorite subjects here on Well, namely TASP and PrEP. Because this month we've had some new data released about how effective HIV treatment as prevention actually is, as well as some unfortunate and frustrating news about PrEP access in Australia. So we'll be chatting with Joe Watson, the former CEO of NAPWA and current member of PBAC, the committee in charge of listing drugs on the PBS. After that, we'll be talking with Dr. Vincent Cornelise from Pren Market Clinic and VAC's own Centre Clinic to get his new take on the TASP data and what's going to happen to PrEP in the near future.
Now, you should probably unpack that. PrEP, I think everyone knows, is pre-exposure prophylaxis, but TASP?
TASP. It's the kind of unfortunate acronym for the concept of treatment as prevention, meaning if people who are on HIV treatment reach certain levels of virus in their blood, namely undetectable virus, that they are incapable, flat out incapable, of transmitting the virus further on.
It's very exciting stuff.
It's actually really okay, I'm trying to not cuss on the air. It's pretty cool. As always, we'd love for you to join the conversation. You can send us an SMS live here in the studio at 0427-JOY-949 or send us an email at onair@joy.org.au.
Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Well on Joy 94.9. Late last Friday, we got some disappointing news from PBAC about PrEP. Gilead Sciences, the company that makes the drug used as PrEP, Truvada, had put in an application to have the drug subsidized on the PBS. But on Friday, we got news that PBAC had rejected that application for various reasons. Fortunately, the HIV community in Australia does have a friend on PBAC who was able to explain that to us. Yesterday, Cal and I had a chat with Joe Watson. Joe is the former CEO of NAPWA and currently serves as the community representative on PBAC, or the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee. Let's have a listen to our conversation from yesterday. We're joined today in the studio by Joe Watson. Joe is the former president of NAPWA, the National Association of People with HIV Australia, and is currently the community representative on the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee, or PBAC. Thank you very, very much for joining us today, Joe. We know you're very busy.
Yeah, no worries, John. And just to correct, I was the former CEO of NAPWA.
Former CEO, sorry. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So as community representative on PBAC, I think it's one of those strange bodies that not many people know about. Could you just give us an explanation of what PBAC is and what it does?
So the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee is the committee that is almost sort of ruled, if you like, by legislation, the arm of government that considers what medicines and drugs should be subsidised for the pharmaceutical benefits scheme. In other words, what are those drugs and medicines that the Australian government wants to value as needing wide access and affordability in the Australian community and are going to be listed on the PBS?
Okay, sounds like quite a big job. As community representative, do you have any particular role on the community? Sorry, on the committee?
The membership of the committee is, again, also dictated by legislation, and for a number of years now, there's always been a permanent position for a consumer nominee.
Okay.
I've been the consumer nominee since 2013, and what I try and do is act as a full committee member in all other senses, but also, obviously, try and liaise back with patient groups in the community about drugs and medicines of particular issue or particular importance as they're being valued by those who are actually going to be using them.
Okay, so you're making sure that there is that voice and that input from the community in the whole process. Okay.
Absolutely. And there are processes and mechanisms for how we try and get that consumer input into the process and the system.
The process with PBAC, obviously, is the listing specifically on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. What does the timeline for something like that look like? So that we heard an outcome on Friday, but when was that application lodged? Just so people get an idea.
Yeah, that's a very good question. The regulatory processes and the system for listing is seen by many to be a very sort of long or drawn out sort of process. But I have to say the PBAC process itself is probably the fastest across all of the system.
Okay.
So the sponsor made a submission back in March, what is called a major submission back in March. So it was the company that makes Truvada put the submission in. And this was a major submission because even though Truvada's been around for a long time, the first time that the company was actually asking for Truvada to be considered for reasons of prevention, quite separate to its indication already for therapeutic use for people living with HIV. And between March and then the July meeting where PBAC as a committee came together to consider that submission, there's a whole range of evaluation and review processes that go on.
Sure.
And PBAC, while PBAC as a committee is considered the expert committee for review, it also has independent review and evaluation bodies who work with the committee to make sure that they can be supported to do both cost-effectiveness consideration as well as clinical consideration of those drugs coming before them.
Okay, so it's not just trusting the data given to you by the applicant. You actually make sure and verify that their information is correct?
Well, that's right.
Okay.
And that package, if you like, that the sponsor's package that they give over for their submission is not only evaluated in its own right, but as you say, the independent evaluators also go and source their own evidence.
Now, I think everybody was everybody in the community was a little surprised by the outcome, knowing that there were three possibilities, a yes, a defer, and a no. I think everybody was surprised when it was a no rather than a defer. Can you explain what criteria does PBAC look at when... what gets something not necessarily PrEP, but what gets something over the line to at least a defer rather than a no?
So a defer is often utilized by the committee when in fact they're just waiting for a part of some more information, or in the instance of TGA and PBAC parallel processing and of an application when you're waiting for a TGA outcome to be known. And the committee, the PBAC committee, is actually not allowed to approve something until TGA regulators have also finished their deliberations and approved something. So you often defer on that basis. But in the case of a first-time major submission, if the committee feels that first-time major submission has not actually delivered what it is required to sign off on, that is that it is cost effectiveness and they have all the information they want before it, then they really have no choice but to reject it.
Okay.
Because they're not waiting for some, you know, minor or small part of the picture to be completed. They actually feel that there's more work to be done by the sponsor, and indeed the sponsor needs to consider their evaluation.
Okay, so it's not as if they have a flawed submission that PBAC will necessarily undertake their own work and say, well, we think you're wrong here, but we're going to substitute our own judgment for that?
Well, no. I mean, I think one of the things that a lot of people don't realise is that the sponsor really holds a lot of the control over this in terms of, firstly, deciding they want to make a submission to PBAC. You know, it's a big process and it's something that the sponsor has to determine it's going to do.
Yeah.
And then once it does it, it's the sponsor who actually says, we'd like to propose this, i.e., we'd like to propose how much we want you to pay us as an Australian government, and we'd like to propose how we want this drug to be used for this indication, i.e., who should get it, how it should be prescribed, and the rest. Now, PBAC has the responsibility, if you like, to consider all of that and determine whether or not they think that's a reasonable set of proposals.
Okay, gotcha.
Well, on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9. I'm Cal, and I'm joined in the studio with my co-host, John. And we're now joined by Joe Watson from the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee. Joe, we were talking a bit earlier on about the PBAC outcomes, and you mentioned cost effectiveness with regard to PrEP. Could you explain that a bit further for someone who's not sure? What exactly does that mean?
So I think, again, people may not necessarily be aware that the committee can't operate outside its legislation in terms of what is required of it before it can make a decision. And one of the big, if you like, frameworks that PBAC as a pharmaceutical benefits committee works towards is this notion of comparative cost effectiveness, which means if there's a new medicine or drug coming before it, they're obliged to consider the place of that medicine and the indication being asked for it as it is compared to either another drug or medicine available for the same purpose or indeed best practice if there's no specific drug or medicine already operating in that space. And the cost effectiveness really comes down to the population that we think we want to target with any drug or medicine that's being asked for. Is that population going to get the effect, and at what price will government be paying for that desired effect? Mm-hmm. And as a health outcome, have a good understanding for government as an advisory committee, saying is the point at which the cost that government will be paying for something is going to deliver, in lay terms, your bang for your buck, as opposed to too high a price for what would be considered too little a benefit.
Okay.
So that's a sort of a rough way of paraphrasing the more technical language around cost effectiveness.
Okay. So in this instance, just so people kind of understand the comparison here, since PrEP, of course, this is the first, I think this is the first drug that's being applied for as HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Is that cost effectiveness comparison then with condoms and other, I guess, risk reduction strategies currently in place?
Yeah, exactly right. Okay. And in Australia, this is the first drug that's come before the committee for this purpose. And so your standard practice or your current practice in terms of preventing transmission of HIV is indeed the condom use and other risk reduction strategies.
Okay. No, it's so when it comes to this application and cost effectiveness and what the applicant has said, if they provide, say, too narrow a scope for prescribing it and for access, would that then say, all right, this isn't going to be cost effective because too few people would access it under this model?
Well, that's right. I mean, there was the issue, which I think is in the wording anyway, that's become publicly available, that the sponsor wanted to limit the subsidy for Truvada to, if you like, that higher risk subset.
Yeah.
Now, for gay men in particular, the at-risk population is obviously bigger than what the sponsor was indicating for people that would become eligible for getting Truvada under their proposal.
Yeah, okay.
Now, PBAC quickly realised, I think, that that's not something that's going to be realistic in terms of community and community use and experience, but also in terms of the prescribers and how they'd like to be able to make it available to the larger group that I think the sponsor was indicating.
Yeah, yeah, it was interesting to see that restriction there in their application, considering the group that's growing most is a group that they didn't even consider. So that clears up a lot,
that's
actually.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's really important to understand that the committee, whatever it's considering for any sort of application, isn't just guided by what the sponsor is suggesting should be the limitation or the extent of how they want to see their drug or medicine being used. The committee has to actually realistically deal with what is community acceptability and what is the likelihood of something being used quite differently out there once it's listed, because that poses a risk to government in terms of obviously cost.
Yeah. So on that note, we had quite a few community organizations and individuals, I understand, make submissions to PBAC to say in support of the application. But what effect did that have on PBAC's decision and reasoning?
In fact, a lot of effect. One of the things that I think the committee has tried to do, especially over the last several years, is really emphasise the value they put on consumer input into the process. Mm. Now, for this application, there was over 100 submissions put through the consumer comments process.
Wow.
And that included a large number of individuals as well as nearly 20 community organisations and networks. So there was strong interest shown by the community, obviously, in supporting this application, and the committee have noted that in their summaries, and also talked about how helpful those submissions were in really pointing out yet again the realistic acceptability of this in the community and the community's sophistication about how it is going to be used in the real world.
Yeah.
So, Joe, what's next? Noting that there is such a community voice kind of behind this and asking questions about this, the conversation around PrEP being listed on the PBS is clearly not over, even if it's a no at this stage. So what are the next steps?
I think the committee was trying to say that, one, they acknowledge that Truvada has a place in terms of trying to reduce the risk of HIV infection. I think that's something that people should really take on board. I think the other thing that people should understand is that the language very clearly shows that the committee felt that the sponsor needed to take on board what they still felt were issues to be sorted out. And as a sponsor, it's now in their, the ball's now in their court, if you like, to come back to the committee with a submission that addresses those two main things.
Okay.
One is, what is the population that really is where we want to consider the use of this drug for prevention reasons, and what is the appropriate price then for all those people that should be eligible for it?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, actually.
Now, in terms of a time cycle on all of this, if the sponsor is going to, commit to another submission, then the cycle would allow it to come back for a major submission for the committee for the March 27 meeting. That's
okay.
How it works in terms of a time cycle.
Yeah.
That company would need to put in a major submission by early November.
Oh, okay. That'd be quite a big undertaking, I imagine.
Yeah. I think for community leaders, it's really now about talking with the company on its plans and how it wants to progress this.
All right. Well, Joe Watson, that is all the time that we have. Thank you for joining us. We will definitely be keeping an eye on the process and following that timeline you've sort of laid out there for us. Thanks for joining us today.
No worries. Thanks, guys.
No worries. Take care. Right. Cheers.
Thanks, Joe.
Joy 94.9.
We're back with Well. And now that we have some insight into the next steps in the process for PrEP, we want to know what it all means for people who want to take PrEP or are already taking PrEP. So joining us now in the studio this evening is Dr. Vincent Cornelis. Vincent is a GP from Brand Market Clinic. You do a stint at Center Clinic in St. Kilda as well. And focuses on HIV and sexual health. Vincent, welcome.
Thank you.
How are you?
I used to work at Center Clinic. I still remember it very fondly, but I ran out of time, unfortunately.
Fair enough, and you've been very busy.
I've been very busy.
Busy boy. Well, like we said, we're all still kind of digesting the implications of what PBAC decided on Friday, and I think we're a bit disappointed. But as somebody who is a PrEP prescriber and works closely with people on PrEP, what's your reaction? What's your take on the situation?
Well, it is very disappointing. I mean, I think it wasn't entirely surprising. There were sort of rumors that this was likely to happen. I think it's disappointing that the submission that was given to PBAC specified that people needed to have a certain amount of risk. I believe it was 3% or more risk of HIV.
Yeah.
I just don't think that's workable in practice, certainly not something that I work with.
And it's quite an odd way to frame it, 3% risk. I mean, could you explain what
Yeah, look, I've got no idea. Who's 3% risk? Like, how do you analyze that? So that's a problem. And, I don't think I have quite strong feelings, and I've expressed these in public quite frequently. I've got quite strong feelings about putting eligibility criteria on a prevention measure such as PrEP. I don't think it's practical. I mean, how am I in the clinic supposed to assess whether someone has 3% risk? And B, I don't think it's fair. I think if someone feels that they have significant risk, or if they feel they have a risk that's high enough to affect their life, then I think they should be entitled to go on to PrEP. And I think that's the only workable way to do it.
And what sort of demand do you see for PrEP out there?
It's quite massive at the moment. So as you probably know, the PrEP-X trial started a few weeks ago.
Yep.
We've been doing, in our clinic, we've been prescribing PrEP for almost 2 years now.
Okay.
But PrEP-X started 3 weeks ago, and the floodgates have opened. It's been very busy.
Yeah, because you're only one of six sites in Melbourne right now operating the study, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
So just for people that haven't heard about PrEP-X before, I mean, if people have listened to Well, chances are they've heard us talk about it. But can you explain PrEP-X and how that's different from, say, the Vic PrEP study?
Yeah, so the Vic PrEP study was really a pilot study that ran in, I believe it started in 2014. It was a bit more restricted as in who could go onto the study. Yep. They really wanted high-risk guys. PrEP-X is a lot more open. There are eligibility criteria for PrEP-X, but I think it's fair to say that they're a lot more flexible than the Vic PrEP criteria. And it's really the Vic PrEP, so the little study that we had, was really to show that it's feasible and safe to deliver PrEP in Victoria. PrEP-X has a different purpose. Its purpose is really to try and roll it out to a large number of people who are at risk of HIV and to see if we can try to get the HIV diagnosis rates down in Victoria. So it's got a different, there's much more public health focus.
And I think it's about 2,700 positions in the PrEP-X trial, isn't
it? It's exactly. Right. I think 26, 27, yeah. It's a large number of people. Vic PrEP was only 120.
And it's only been open, about 3 weeks? We've already got 1,000 people signed up?
1,200, 1,163 as of today.
But who's counting, John?
Well, the little email that I get every week on my PrEP-X study update.
Well, but I think it is an important point. So we're just about halfway. And I think PrEP-X is particularly important for people who have financial difficulties, because there are, as I said, we've been prescribing PrEP for 2 years, so there are ways for people to access PrEP currently, or there were before PrEP-X started, so there was ways for people to import PrEP themselves and do it safely with assistance. But it's a bit more expensive, and for people who've got healthcare cards who might not be able to afford to import PrEP themselves, PrEP-X is really important. So if you're out there and you think you're at risk of HIV and you've got a healthcare card, come and see us as soon as possible so we can make sure you get a spot on PrEP-X.
Yeah, because that was one of the disappointing things about the decision, is there are a lot of people who simply can't afford PrEP to import it. And now they just have to wait even longer, especially if they can't get a space on PrEP-X. Is that?
Yeah. Exactly.
Equity being one of the primary grounds for wanting to get the PBAC recommendation through. So what do we do? Like, if you can't get that space on PrEP-X because it is filling up quickly and some spaces need to be reserved for rural and regional people when it rolls out there. So what do we tell people who need PrEP or want PrEP?
Like I said, first of all, you know, if you need it, you hear me talk, ring up and make an appointment tomorrow morning so we can get you onto PrEP. And for the other people, I think, you know, we've been very lucky, particularly in Victoria, that we've had some really good grassroots support from the community. Organizations such as PrEP Access Now have been fantastic at organizing access to PrEP for people who can't afford to buy it themselves. So they had a really good scheme going, and I guess it's still going, but it's less important right now with PrEP-X being open for enrollment. But it may, you know, with this PBAC decision may become important again.
But we should say too as well, if you're talking about PrEP-X, that's restricted to Victoria, isn't it?
Yeah, and New South Wales has got one.
And
as well.
Queensland has one, and but Queensland. South Australia...
Queensland will have one. It's still in process.
Okay. But if you're in South Australia, Northern Territory, what, WA...
Tasmania.
PrEP Access Now is sort of, I guess, a scheme that's a viable option for you, if not personal importation. Yeah. Is that right?
No, exactly. Yeah, so PrEP Access Now is not restricted to Victoria. It's simply a grassroots organization that's been set up by some members of the community just to assist other people in the community to access PrEP.
Okay.
So if anyone is out there who can't get access to a trial, then that's certainly a good way to go about it.
Though one of the issues that's not really talked about, and there's a gray area right now, because you're what's known as an S100 prescriber, is that correct?
Correct.
So you've gone through training that says you are aware of HIV medications like Truvada, all the complications that might come up with HIV, but right now, any doctor right now can actually prescribe PrEP, is that correct?
It's a funny situation. So PrEP, the prescription of PrEP has been approved by the Therapeutic Goods Administration in Australia, which is a separate organization from PBAC.
Yes.
So the people get confused about this. So the Therapeutic Goods Administration simply makes an assessment to see whether a medication is safe for use and fit for purpose. So they approved, many years ago, they approved Truvada for treating HIV, and earlier this year they approved the use of Truvada for prevention, so for PrEP. Technically, any doctor, any GP can prescribe PrEP. Whether they want to or not is a separate matter, because if they're completely unfamiliar with PrEP, then they may not feel comfortable prescribing it for someone.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the things in the decision by PBAC, or one of the way it was put to them, was that it was, I believe, only going to be prescribable by S100 GPs.
Well, that's one of the reasons we understand anyway. One of the reasons the application was knocked back was because they confined it to S100 prescribers instead of saying we need to open this up to all prescribers, or at least a broader class of prescribers.
And I think that's fair enough. I think PrEP, if done properly, and it's not rocket science, it is easy to do it safely with suitable monitoring by a doctor.
Yeah.
And with ASHM, with the Australasian Society for HIV Medicine, we've been working to get some guidelines out there. So there's certainly plenty of clinical guidelines for doctors to be able to do this safely, even if they've never done it before.
Yeah, that's excellent. So I guess one of the things, going back again to the equity thing, because there are S100 prescribers in all states and territories, but in places like Northern Territory, Tasmania,
there are only two,
one or two,
yeah,
if you're lucky. So it's going back to when you said...
Just same in Tasmania.
Yeah, well, and even in New South Wales, Victoria, they're concentrated in Melbourne and Sydney. So yeah, if you live outside those areas, it's quite difficult. Are you aware of when the study will be expanding, PrepX will be expanding to the rural areas?
There's lots of talk about it. I believe Bendigo has been lined up as a potential. Oh, sorry, it was, and now unfortunately that doctor has gone overseas. So I don't know where. Sorry, that just reminded me. So there's certainly active efforts to roll it out to rural sites, but I don't know when that's likely to happen.
Yeah. I think what you just mentioned there is what's so interesting is it is really reliant on those doctors that have engaged themselves, that have educated themselves and feel confident to really kind of engage in that space. And if you don't have them there, it really complicates how you know, the logistics behind implementation with regard to regional and rural and hard to reach kind of areas.
That's correct.
So yeah, that's one of the definitely big challenges there. Yeah, I think there's a lot more to unpack with this. Vince, stay with us. We are talking to Vincent Cornelis about the recent outcomes from the PBAC decision on PrEP, and I believe we'll be talking a little bit about the partner study and treatment as prevention. You're listening to Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9.
Seahorse Victoria is a social and support group for the transgender community.
For the transgender community.
Seahorse Victoria, providing support to the community since 1975.
Share your issues, problems, and successes with others who identify as trans in a safe and supportive social environment.
Find out more at seahorsevic.com.au.
Joy 94.9 is proud to support this community message.
You are back with Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9. We're in the studio with Vincent Cornelis from Paran Market Clinic. We had one last question about PrEP. Risk, eligibility, it's this fuzzy kind of area. Who should be taking PrEP? Who's eligible for it?
It's a good question. Look, officially with PrEP-X, because there's two separate issues. There's eligibility for PrEP as a whole and there's eligibility for PrEP-X, which fortunately those two questions are not too different. As I said to you before, I think, in my personal opinion, anyone who feels they need PrEP is eligible for PrEP. The PrEP-X eligibility criteria, which are obviously set by the study itself, they're quite open as well. And I think it's particularly, I just wanted to point out that PrEP-X is not just for men who have sex with men. Obviously, that has been the main target group so far, just because that's where the HIV epidemic in Victoria is. But the study is not restricted to men who have sex with men. So women are allowed to join PrEP-X as well. Transgender people are welcome to join PrEP-X as well. And I think that's really important. I haven't had any transgender people present for PrEP yet, and I'm just worried that the PrEP message is not getting into the trans community.
Yeah, it is difficult. I know there's a group called PASH-TM that's developed a position statement and some guidance on that for trans men. But yeah, for trans women, I haven't seen much of anything out there. So hopefully word gets out that there is space for that.
And yeah, come and see us.
A willingness to work with the community to help. So yeah, that's good. That's really good to hear.
And actually, I might just jump in here. We actually had a message in the studio that said, "Hi, thanks for the clarification on PrEP. The outcome from PBAC is a worry, but I am thankful for your show updating us all. Cheers, Gavin." So Gavin, thanks for jumping in. Anyone else, if you are listening tonight and you want to jump in on the conversation, you can SMS us here in studio at 0427-JOY-949, or better yet, shoot us an email onair@joy.org.au. Now, Vincent, we did mention earlier that you're an S100 prescriber, which means that you're I guess, authorized, registered to prescribe.
They gave me a sash when I got it.
Okay, that's gorgeous.
Queen, yeah.
But it means you're able to do, it's not only just HIV medication, is it?
S100, there's different categories of S100 authorization, and there's ones for HIV, hepatitis B, and previously hepatitis C, but that's just undergone a massive change.
Mostly HIV that you're dealing with?
HIV and Hep C and a little bit of Hep B.
Okay, all right. Well, with that in mind, something we mentioned earlier is the idea of treatment as prevention. And I guess, first of all, would you want to explain that to anyone who maybe never have heard of treatment as prevention? Is TASP, or is it something?
Yeah, look, I think treatment and prevention and PrEP are two really complementary topics. So treatment as prevention basically refers to the concept that when someone's living with HIV and they're on treatment and they have an undetectable viral load, which is the vast majority of people on treatment, in that situation, the chance of that person passing HIV on to someone else during sex is really, really minimal. And there have been there's been a couple of studies on this, and particularly the partner study and HPTN052, who released their results last month, I think.
I believe it was AIDS 2016. Yeah,
in Durban. And it's very exciting. I think particularly the partner study is relevant to men who have sex with men. I've wrote the numbers down because I couldn't remember them. So they started in 2010 and they enrolled more than 1,000 couples, and they looked at only couples where one partner is positive and one partner is negative to look at the risk of transmission between those partners. Out of those over 1,000 people, they followed up 888 of them. The other ones were lost to follow up. And out of those 888, 340 couples were men who have sex with men, and the rest of the couples were heterosexual. There's no mention of transgender people, but which is a shame.
So we don't know whether or not there was.
The question might not have been asked. That's the problem with a lot of these things, is the question often isn't asked.
They just don't ask what people's gender identity is and what the birth assigned sex is.
It's a shame.
The inclusion criteria. So the with the couples, it was important though that the couples were only allowed to be in a study if they had sex without condoms. So with the men who have sex with men, it had to be anal sex, and with the heterosexual couples, vaginal sex or anal sex. Well, you know, they're allowed to enjoy that too. And then the other inclusion criteria were that the positive partners had to have an undetectable viral load, so they had to be on treatment, and their viral load had to be less than 200 copies per mil. 200 copies per mil consistently.
Oh, wow.
It's
not clinical
undetectable.
It's
not clinical undetectable, exactly. And that's a really important point, I think, because clinically what we use is 20 copies per mil or less.
And even sometimes some tests, it's 50 or less. It just depends.
The older tests are 50, it's now 20. And then on top of that, it will even if it's less than 20, it will still say detected or undetected under 20.
So
the study used 200.
So that's just a low viral load, basically.
That just got lost in the ratios, which is great, You're both very excited about this, and it is exciting news. But really, what you're saying, and this is actually news to me, is that in a partner study, the people actually, in some instances, may have had a higher viral load than what most people consider undetectable from a clinical level.
Yeah.
So if that's even at that criteria, what do we know about actual transmissions?
Well, the reality obviously would have been that most of those people would have been fully undetectable.
Okay.
But they used 200 as a cutoff just so that to not avoid confusion when people have little tiny blips.
Okay.
Because sometimes when people are on treatment and they're taking their treatment, they can still have little blips for reasons that we're not really sure about. 200 copies per mil. And the HIV negative partner, in order for the couple to be included, the HIV negative partner was not allowed to have used PEP or PrEP.
Mm.
So those are the couples. Positive partner, undetectable. HIV negative partner, not using PEP or PrEP, and having sex without condom.
So it just boiled down to, is treatment an effective prevention tool for HIV?
Yeah. And basically it is. So out of, in those couples over those years, they've had, how many 50, times they have sex?
58,000
times did people have sex without condoms.
For fun, some of us calculated the volume of the...
Okay.
In addition,
there was a lot of sex. There was a lot of sex between those couples.
Yes.
And what do we know from that?
Well, out of that, there was not a single transmission of HIV from a positive partner to a negative partner.
Let's let that sit for a second there. That's a pretty staggering.
58,000 and not a single one.
So, I mean, what does that information do for people that are achieving undetectable viral load and that are successfully on treatment? What kind of, I guess, mental health impact?
I think it's very important. I mean, that's just to clarify. So it's 58,000 types of sex without condoms, not a single transmission. From that, you know, because we're, you know, all these very conservative, they did statistical calculations, and we never say that, never say never. No, it's not zero risk. And they calculated a confidence interval, because people might come across this, which basically calculated a worst-case scenario. For men who have sex with men, the worst-case scenario, based on these statistics, is that there's a chance of 0.84 transmissions of HIV per 100 couple years. So if you have a couple having sex for 100 years at a median of, 48 times per year, once a week, I think that's pretty reasonable, then the chance of having HIV is still less than one, or transmitting HIV. But the reality is... No, there was not a single transmission. So I think this is really important for patients living with HIV. I think this really can put a bit of confidence in knowing that being on treatment and being undetectable basically prevents transmission to your sexual partners.
So, and the other thing, I guess, just to clarify here, now this study, the partner studies took place where?
Oh, God, that's a good question. I think it was USA.
It was all over the world.
South America somewhere.
So how does this, I guess the question I have is, how does this play out in Australia? How many people are on treatment relatively? Do we have any idea how many people are on treatment?
Australia is, I like to boast about Australia every now and then. We didn't do so well in the Olympics, but we're doing very well on getting people on HIV treatment. Australia's got... So the global goal is the 90-90-90 goal, which you probably would have heard about. So it's 90% of people who are living with HIV being diagnosed, and 90% of those being put on treatment that sounds super paternalistic. 90% of those people having access to treatment and taking that treatment, and then 90% of people on treatment getting an undetectable viral load. Okay. So that's the 90-90-90 rule. And in Australia, we're actually really, really close to achieving that. And we're probably the world leader in achieving that target.
Yeah,
we're certainly doing a lot better than the United States and most of Europe.
That's kind of not surprising, considering how freaking amazing the healthcare system is, whatever people might think of its inefficiencies.
Okay, so I'm going to jump to a question here, because we are running out of time. But I think for a lot of guys that are hearing this information, it doesn't necessarily be exclusive to guys, but if the a question that they might ask you as a GP is, if they, whoever they are, male, female, whatever, if they're talking to someone else and that person says that they're undetectable, does that mean, what advice will you give them with regard to like HIV prevention? I mean, are they safe? Should they be having condomless sex? What considerations should they take on board?
Yeah, look, they're really good questions. And it's basically, if you take the sort of raw message, if you say, I'm having sex with someone who is undetectable, who is on treatment and is undetectable, then I would say, look, the risk of getting HIV from that person is practically nothing. And like I said, it's not zero, possibly, but out of 58,000 times having sex, there wasn't a single transmission. So, how close to zero do you want to get? But, for some people, that might still not be enough. Some people do have really high anxiety about HIV, but also about other STIs, obviously. And for those people, I say, look, if that's not enough for you. So if we're talking about a couple that are having sex and they know each other, and the negative partner knows that the positive partner is on treatment and undetectable, if that's still not enough, then I think it's quite reasonable for the negative partner to consider going on PrEP. If they want, if you want to wear a belt and braces, that's okay. Your pants won't fall down. Yep. I think it's different in when you're dealing with casual sexual partners or anonymous partners. I think if you're talking about fuck buddies, then I think with fuck buddies and friends with benefits, you kind of know what's going on with the other person. But if you're meeting guys in a sauna or on Grindr, and you're not really sure what their story is, and they're just telling you that they're on treatment and undetectable, if you're relying on that as your safety strategy, then I'd say, look, you're really better off going on PrEP, because you don't know these people. And in the end, it comes down to trust. So it's if you're having sex with people that you know and trust and they're undetectable, then I think that's a perfectly good prevention strategy. But outside of that, I think taking control of yourself and going on PrEP would be a good idea. And obviously, both of these strategies don't protect against other sexually transmitted infections.
Yep, an important takeaway, definitely.
I think there's something to remember, too. I keep hearing this, and I'm getting on a little bully pulpit, but hearing there's one word that keeps popping up, and we kind of ignore it sometimes, but it is the word people. No matter a person's status, that is a person behind it. So whatever their background is, whatever they're saying, wherever they're coming from, I think part of reducing stigma in that aspect of PrEP and TASP, we need to remember that there are people behind this and we need to treat them kindly and with respect and compassion rather than stigma and fear and discrimination. So hopefully all of us moving forward, whatever situations we might find ourselves in sexually, can be a little more generous and a little more kind to one another.
Yeah, and I think for me personally, or professionally, this is a really exciting time because previously we were just beating people over the head with condoms and going, you must use condoms. If you're not using condoms, you must use condoms. And that's like the only thing we could do.
Yeah, yeah.
And now we can engage honestly with people and we say, look, okay, what is happening in your life? What are you doing? Yeah. What sort of sex are you having? And, you know, what... No, there are things I can do to help you manage your risk and give you a healthy, enjoyable sex life and without the risk that it might have had.
Which is pretty freaking amazing.
It's pretty awesome.
Dr. Vincent.
Dr. Vincent, of course.
You know, he went to school for it. You may as well give him, you know, give him a title there. At least you went to school for it, didn't you?
If
it was a school that gave you a sash, I'm suddenly questioning his credentials.
I've got so many sashes.
There you go. Dr. Vincent Cornelise, thank you so much for joining us. That's been, hugely informative and always great to hear that conversation as it continues on. Also, thank you earlier to Joe Watson from PBAC for chatting with us. Really both have helped unpack a lot of rather difficult information on these topics. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, John, that is it us for another week. But there are a few things coming up. I think in one of the previous shows, we were talking about HIV and Hep C. What's going on there?
Yes. So VAC is running a forum called 2-in-1, Managing HIV and Hepatitis C Co-Infection, which is actually quite a big freaking deal here. So alongside all this exciting information about TASP, there are also some incredible, incredible new treatments about hepatitis C that have become available in Australia recently. So we have gathered together a panel of experts and some people who have experienced these treatments and the old hepatitis treatments for that matter to talk about them, to just answer questions that people in the community might have, whether you're co-infected, whether you just have one or the other, whether you're at risk of either of them. We want you to come along this Wednesday night, the 24th of August at 6:30 p.m. at the Hare Hole at Hares and Hyenas, the bookshop on Johnston Street, Fitzroy. It's a free event. Bring your questions. Bring them no matter how embarrassing, stupid, offensive, ridiculous you might think they are. They're important questions and we want to answer them. And it is in an informal, a friendly, and judgment-free space. So again, it's this Wednesday, 24th of August, 6:30 p.m. at Hares and Hyenas. That is now all the time we have for this week. You've been listening to Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9. Thank you so much for joining us and have an incredibly pleasant evening.
Take care. Good night, all.
Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.